Hey, Chicago, it's Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Make sure you stick around because later in the episode, we'll break down today's biggest stories in the Chicago area. But first, the youngest son of civil rights icon, Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr., is stepping into a pivotal moment. He's just taken the helm of the Rainbow Push Coalition. That's the organization that his father founded decades ago to fight for justice and equity. So what does leadership look like for the next generation? And how do you carry that mission forward in a time that feels more divided than ever? We're going to sit down with him to talk about his vision, his priorities, and what keeps him going when the work feels especially tough. At the table was Yusuf Jackson, president and CEO of Rainbow Push. Now, he started things off with some really kind words for us here at WBEZ and for all of you who reached out to the family after the loss of Reverend Jesse Jackson. Here's Yusuf.
I want to say that how grateful the Jackson family is and how honored we are to have been for your station and for the media generally. Many people in Chicago and around the world who have been so kind to us during our moment of grief with my father. Mm-hmm. The number of condolences and the messages, the Instagram messages, the SMSs, all of the wonderful memories that were shared about our father from other people. We're so grateful. It was sustaining to us mm-hmm. at a time that was really intense. So thank you very kindly to your listening base and to the city.
It has been nearly 2 months since your father died. And so I wonder how you're doing and how the family is doing now.
You know, I think we're all dealing with it differently. We haven't, since that intense three-week period from February 17th through the beginning of March when we were able to celebrate his homegoing services, we haven't had a chance to really sit down and talk about it.
Yeah.
But I'm grateful that my mother's healthy and she's strong. She's taking a different pace. She's doing projects that make sense for her.
Good.
My brothers are working. You know, it's interesting. On April 4th, 1968, after Dr. King was killed, my father was 26 years old on the bottom level of the Lorraine Motel, and Dr. King was shot, obviously, on the balcony. And he got a lot of it was a controversial decision, but he made the decision to keep working, even though he was 26. Mm-hmm. His mentor, his friend, had just been killed. And February 17th, 2026, we also made the decision to keep working. And so somewhere between the pain and through the grief, you have to develop the intestinal fortitude to keep the movement going. My father made that decision in 1968. We continue to make that decision in 2026. So we have a legacy of continuing the work in spite of the pain. That makes the pain somewhat easier to manage because the spirit of my father stays with us longer.
Yeah. Well, your father left a lot of work for you.
Well, he
left a huge legacy for you to
move. He left us 60 years forward to figure out and kind of dissect in public life and public service. He also left us the opportunity to build bridges in his death as well. So he still continues to work, and we feel him every day. I miss him. You know, I talk to him a lot.
Do you?
Well, I used to. Well, I haven't talked to him recently. But I talked to him a lot when he was living. He advised us literally until the day he died. Mm-hmm. He was very active. Even as his voice was taken and his legs were taken, his mind stayed active. It was the most amazing thing. His mind never left us. He stayed sharp. So I was honored to be able to serve with him and then be available for his advice in my older age.
Well, on Saturday, you presided over your first forum as official president of Rainbow Push.
That's right.
What did that moment feel like?
I never thought I would do this work personally, and I never thought I'd do the work without him.
Hmm.
So in that sense, it's overwhelming, but it's an honor that he entrusted me with the legacy and the leadership and the body of work to use my body to serve.
It's funny you say you never thought that you would do this work because I know that you sort of raised your hand and you stepped up to do this the day after he died.
You know, I think that all of the Jacksons have been trained and we're prepared to do the work. Service is in our bones. I mean, we were born with the aptitude to serve and the attitude to serve. And so I've seen my father serve all my life. I've been with him. You know, I was his executive assistant. I was his special assistant. I worked for him. He fired me. I had only been
what
fired.
What did you do?
I promise it wasn't my fault.
Okay.
He fired me. I was like, Dad, I'm the only person you've ever fired. It was the craziest thing.
Then you did something. You can tell me offline.
You know, so we've been through a lot. And he taught us, you know, this. There's a reservoir of patience you need, a reservoir of tolerance and understanding you need to serve. So we all have it. You know, I remember finally, literally just outside of Navy Pier in the early 80s, picketing Chicago Fest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were born basically on a picket line. And it was embarrassing, actually, because your friends would be driving by and seeing you, and they'd say little funny things, and they might very well go to the show. And we're there protesting, looking for opportunities for African-Americans and Hispanics to work as vendors.
Right.
So we had a serious agenda, even though we were young people. And there you develop a strength to serve. And so I'm honored to be in this position right now.
Tell me the best piece of advice that you received from your father about leadership.
My father gave us a lot of advice, but I think one that stands out is when your head is in the mouth of a lion, you rest yourself from it very gently.
Break that down for me.
It simply means you can't rush into things and rush out of things. You know, there's a fullness of time that you have to have the maturity to take your time when you're in the midst of a certain season. Sometimes there are rainy seasons that we have, and you can't fight the rain. You've got to get your umbrella and brave the rain and the storms until the sun comes up again. It's almost, weeping may endure for a night, but joy cometh in the morning. The morning time is coming, but you have to endure the rainy season.
Mm. As our society becomes more secular, what role do you see faith playing in the advancement of Rainbow Push and the social justice goals?
You know, it's important for us. We believe fundamentally that God made a pact with humanity, that if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and turn from their wicked ways and seek my face, you'll hear from heaven, I'll heal their land. That if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you can move mountains. So the commitment of Jeremiah saying that God will write the law in your heart, not just on the tablets, that commitment is what drives us in our organization. And from there, it is our sense of religion that makes us political. So from the God's commitment, we have the faith to do the work. It's interesting. If you think about that, we're approaching the 250th anniversary of our country.
Yes.
The Declaration of Independence said that we hold these truths to be inevitable, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that we were endowed from our Creator with certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. That commitment that Thomas Jefferson made required the fidelity of the people to fight on behalf of the Union. And the commitment was that we would have a government of, for, and by the people. That promise was made but not kept. You can't do that half slave and half free. And then you think about the Civil Rights era legislation, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and the Public Accommodations Bill. Those legislative acts were designed to bridge the gaps that Jim Crow, separate but equal, and disenfranchisement had created. When you think about those gaps, they persist today. And so we're gathering June 10 through 13 mm-hmm. in Chicago to talk about, on the eve of the Declaration of Independence anniversary, fulfilling the American promise to its people for the next generation. Because we've got to assess where we are from the very first document through the civil rights legislation. If we get this thing right, if we can cure the trade deficit between black and brown people and our government, it's worth $5 trillion over the next 5 years. That means that if African Americans and brown people were paid dollar for dollar along with the median, if we had the same ownership rates, same graduation rates, if we can bridge those gaps, it's $5 trillion.
Yeah.
So in that sense, I find us worth investing in. You think about the underbelly of the country. Middle-class white people are in peril also. And as the middle class softens, the poverty class gets worse too. And so there's a large amount of the country that needs this country to work for itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not right now.
Talk to me about the most pressing issues you see right now.
You know, one of the beautiful things of my father was he had a voice that commanded media attention. He had a face, I've been saying this, that was more recognizable than the current Pope probably. At one time, he was in line with, you know, John Paul II, who was a pretty popular pope. We inherit the legacy of his work. We inherit his blueprint. But we don't inherit that voice and that face. We've got to earn that on our own. And so we're going door to door, county to county, state to state. What I'm trying to convince people of is the following, and here's the most important thing I think we're doing. We're teaching civics right now. The civil rights advocates, those who were responsible for the 64, 65, and 68 legislation, that's a smaller group, and they're considered basically, you know, Dr. King, Reverend Jackson, Andy Young, those type of people. The beneficiaries of civil rights is like 80% of the country. If you look at women's athletics all across, from gymnastics to basketball to volleyball to soccer, if you look at African-American participation in PWIs, if you look at the immigration since 1965 from Cuba, from Venezuela, from Africa, from all the non-Western European places, 80% of the country is a beneficiary of the Civil Rights Act. The beneficiaries of the Civil Rights Act, it's their responsibility now to teach civil rights advocacy. As the original advocates go on to glory, the beneficiaries must take that work and expand rights for other people. So the right to citizenship, the right to vote, is really the burden of the beneficiaries. It is wrong to have a family who immigrated here in 1965 or anywhere just after 1965 and have taken the early bus and work to put your children through school. Mm-hmm. And now those sons and daughters are running restaurants, running businesses, and they don't really understand how you got here and why. You got here because of the Civil Rights Act. You got here because of the Immigration Act. And now it's your opportunity to teach other people the value of that work. And so connecting the civil rights advocates and the civil rights beneficiaries is what we're doing right
now. You're connecting the past with the future.
That's important.
You've got four pillars that you've identified as priorities: education, which you've already touched on a little bit there, human rights, economic justice, and workforce development, as well as voting rights, right? Voter registration in particular. We talked when your father died, we talked with Dr. Alvin Tillery on the program. He's from Northwestern University. And a quote that sort of sticks with us is where he was talking about your dad, and he said, you know, he's the last of the great mobilizers. The last of the great mobilizers. Some people are disengaged right now when you think about voting, right? They're disinvested from our electoral process. So when you look ahead to the midterms coming up later this year, what's your formula for uniting people and moving them to action?
You know, my dad was a great mobilizer, and that's an honor for him to say that. My father might very well disagree with that. He believed in the future of the country, and he believed in what we were doing very strongly. He thought that he laid a foundation for the work we're doing, but he wasn't the end-all, be-all of it. He registered a lot of voters. He was a great mobilizer. He spoke in a cadence that was attractive to people, and he gave his life to it, and I think he had that kind of standing with people. You know, there's a lot of work being done right now that's unsold. We went to Minneapolis, the Rainbow Push Coalition, and we met with Haitians, Somalis, Jews, and peace activists, and African Americans. And it seemed to us that the battle there, on the wake of Pam Bondi saying that if you give us your voter rolls, we will allow we'll take away ICE. The battle is over citizenship for the Somalis and the extension of citizenship, the right to vote. The battle John Lewis was fighting in 1965, citizenship and the right to vote, as an aside. African Americans were not fully enfranchised by law until 1965, after the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So it wasn't until 1965. I've got one brother, Jonathan, mm-hmm. born enfranchised, and one brother, Jesse, born disenfranchised, 1964 and 1965. It was cut that way. I was born in 1970 in the enfranchised group. And so that's new for us as a full citizen. That's why my parents could see us going backwards. I can't imagine us going backwards because I never saw the backwards.
It's all you knew.
They saw it. They saw it on both of them. So we saw that and we said, hey, let's all go to Selma and cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Why? Because the battle's the same. You're not seeing the 61-year connection between the battle. This is our River Jordan. So I'll offer, we took 250 people.
This was back in March.
In March. Yep. We took 250 people to the Selma Jubilee from D.C., from Chicago, from Minneapolis. We took buses. The same route that my father took as a student at the University of Chicago in 1965 is a route we took on that bus. They drove down and they crossed that bridge. I'm saying this. If you're in Cook County jail, if you're in Cook County right now waiting to register non-felons to vote, if you are in Springfield pushing the Jesse Jackson Voter Empowerment Act, where high school students have an opportunity for a voter registration card and a diploma at the same time. Mm-hmm. If you're doing that kind of work, you're a voting rights advocate. And so you're seeing yourself, but you must see yourself connected in the movement of voting rights advocacy. There are a lot of registrars, a lot of people who are working to improve bilateral ballots or mail-in bilingual ballots or mail-in ballots. The movement is afoot. When mm-hmm. you look at like how big the King's marches are, the No King's marches are, there's a lot of mobilization going on.
Social media is helping too.
It is right? indeed, but it's got to be grounded in a philosophy. And the difference between what you're seeing now, I think, and what we're able to do, the sustainable that Dr. King taught us, is a philosophy of nonviolent, militant nonviolence. And so you have to have the moral imperative. You've got to keep your moral code going forward. And you have to follow the rules that he set forth with respect to boycotting and marching. And then you have successful campaigns.
I'm curious, what's the nature of your relationship with our president, President Trump?
The nature of my relationship with President Trump.
Has he reached out? Have you?
No. We invited him to the services. He wasn't able to make it. He did send us a video, which was very kind. We didn't show any videos at the service, so it wasn't appropriate to share that video at the service. So we do plan to share that video along with other video honors that people offer for my father. We don't really have a relationship. I haven't seen him since the 90s, I don't think.
As this war rages on in the Middle East and Iran.
But I will offer, I pray for him. Because he's in a powerful position. And I think everyone who should understand the position that he's in, we pray that he makes better and better decisions. And that's a prayer that we'll continue to pray on. We were taught in our home, we don't make fun of our adversaries. We don't make fun of people for the decisions they make. We pray they make better decisions, and we try to work on common ground with them. So there are some things he does good, and there's a body of work that he does. And I think to make fun of him is a mistake. He's too powerful for that.
Do you have a message for him as we watch this war rage on in Iran?
The inalienable rights that we talked about in the Declaration of Independence, the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, is a God-given right to all people in the world, not just Americans. And he should think about that. I think that life wasn't ours to make and life isn't ours to take. That's for our Creator.
Rainbow Push has got this history, as we know, of fighting for economic justice for Black people and people of color in America. How will the organization address the growing chasm between rich and poor, especially right now as we look at the price of goods and gas and everything continuing to rise?
These times are perilous. I mean, it's the middle class is under increasing pressure. The African American and brown class is under increasing pressure. I think industry by industry, if you think about this, I just saw in the paper the other day that the president and the attorney general are going after medical schools to challenge their acceptance practices. These are small schools. They have 100 students per class, 200 students per class. There are only 3 or 4 African-American, 5 or 6 Hispanics in a class to start. And you want to reduce that number so they have fewer and fewer Black and brown doctors? If you don't have doctors in your neighborhood, you don't have a sustainable middle class. If you go throughout all of the professional schools, business, doctors, lawyers, we're underrepresented. And as I say again, it's a terrible mistake on behalf of the country, because if you don't close those gaps, you're not investing in the right part of the world. If you're able to close those gaps, if we can get to that dream of the Civil Rights Act, it's a $5 trillion increase in our GDP. That's not peanuts. That's a big deal. Mm-hmm. In 5 years, by investing at home without the foreign risk.
So given all of that and what we just discussed and all that we're seeing in the world right now, what is motivating you at this moment, Yusuf?
Oh, I'm on fire. I'm absolutely, but there's so much. Look, I'm honored to be entrusted with this, with a legacy of service. I feel supported from my family. I feel supported from my mother, my brothers, my sisters. This is not something that I really wanted. It wasn't something I worked, but I was prepared for it. My father says success happens when preparation meets opportunity. So I was prepared. The opportunity presented itself, and here we are. I've had a fairly successful business career, and I'm not here by myself. My success isn't. There were people who took the early bus to Operation Push, now Rainbow Push, from Robbins, Illinois, and from Blue Island, and who came. More people participated, poor people who caught the early bus, in my family to raise us because they put their faith and hope in the Jackson boys and the Jackson girls to be somebody, to be something. The last thing I'd ever want to do is to buy more and more material things, separating myself from these people and not doing more and more work on their behalf. And so I'm honored now to fully offer my body and the knowledge that I have to offer my service to improve our country.
We've been speaking with Yusuf Jackson, the new president and CEO of the Rainbow Push Coalition. Congrats again, and thank you for being here.
Thank you, it's an honor.
For a look at the top stories of the day in Chicago and Illinois, from the opening of the Latino Film Festival to the latest happenings in Springfield. At the table was Claire Lane, WBEZ's Morning Edition anchor, Mawa Iqbal, our Statehouse reporter, and Ambar Colon, an arts and culture reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. Many of us woke up to the news of a flood watch, so Claire kicked things off with a weather report.
Here's what you need to know, is that we've been breaking a lot of weather-related records recently. You remember those couple of really warm days we saw in March? And last night, Chicago saw a record amount of rain. So the National Weather Service recorded 2.43 inches of rain. That is exact. And O'Hare breaking the previous record that was 1.21, set back in 1949. So a significant increase in that. Yesterday was actually the sixth rainiest April day on record for the city's entire history.
So someone's keeping track of that.
Someone is keeping track of the flooding, too. And so that's why we have this flood watch in effect until 1 a.m. tomorrow, actually, because we're going to continue to see more showers, more thunderstorms across the day. And a lot of these afternoon storms could bring some just isolated downpours, which has the potential for flooding, especially for folks who live near rivers, high standing water, things of that nature. Yeah. So be on the lookout. Get those wellies handy.
Yeah. I mean, the rain, you know, in general is a good thing. We look forward to the rain for our greenery, our plants, et cetera. But flood levels, now that's something entirely different.
That is something entirely different, and sometimes actually has a couple of tips from Brett Chase about what you can do to prevent flooding in your home at suntimes.com.
Awesome. Well, Ambar, if folks want to get out of the rain, they can catch a movie. The Chicago Latino Film Festival is starting tomorrow. What should we know about this?
Yeah, so the Chicago Latino Film Festival is probably one of my favorite events that takes place every year. It starts tomorrow. It goes through April 27th. It happens at the Landmark Century Center Cinema over in Lakeview. And they have so many great titles this year. I think it's over 80. There's four locally made shorts, which I have a story upcoming about that.
Tell me more.
Yeah, there's a lot of exciting titles. Mexico's first animated film. Like the first animated film that's ever been completed.
Oh, wow.
The entire crew, everything is Mexican. So it's called Soy Franquela by Roy and Arturo Ambriz. They're two brothers that are just like huge in the world of animation. So it's making its U.S. premiere here in Chicago. The film is also coming to Netflix, but why not watch it here?
Support the Latino Film Festival and watch it here.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I can't believe it's taken this long for the very first animated film, but I can believe it. And I'm just glad we're here.
Yeah. What? They have another animated film in this year's festival, which is something sort of new to the fest. They've mostly focused on like live action and documentary style films. So the other animated film is called They Dream from Puerto Rico. And that one mixes like 2D and 3D animation along with like archival footage, photographs, and all kinds of really cool stuff.
Nice. Very exciting. Mawa, Illinois lawmakers in Springfield, they've been busy with the spring legislative session and they're currently debating a millionaire's tax. First of all, what is this proposed tax?
Hey, Sasha. Yes, you are correct. They have been very busy. Things have definitely been picking up down here in Springfield. So this millionaire's tax, for people who may have remembered the initiative from 2024 and 2014, it's kind of like deja vu, right? It's basically, it would impose a 3% surcharge tax on people whose incomes are $1 million or higher. And basically, lawmakers are trying to get the amendment or get it passed as a ballot amendment to put in front of voters on the November 3rd general election ballot. And this time, what's different from the previous times is that, you know, in the previous times, these were like advisory questions on the ballot. So it's like, you know, voters, do you think we should do a millionaire's tax? Yes or no? And it's actually been approved by voters. But, you know, with an advisory amendment, it's just like a recommendation, right? Mm. So this time they want to do a binding referendum, which would mean that it's like it's actually going to happen if the voters do pass it in November.
Now, Illinois House Speaker Chris Welch had thrown his support behind that proposed tax. I want to play a little bit of what he told you.
I personally believe, first and foremost, we need an additional stream of revenue. And that's a legitimate stream that's been identified. I think that stream of revenue can help schools, it can help property tax relief, it can certainly help the state with our pension obligations.
What else did he tell you, Mala?
You know, affordability has kind of become like his buzzword, I would say, which is something, you know, I feel like we've heard on the campaign trail for the March primaries, you know, last month. But certainly with leadership, Democratic leadership in Springfield, They're definitely, you know, tackling this whole issue of affordability. And so Chris Welch, the speaker, right, he says that, you know, millionaire's tax, making people who earn more pay more and helping like working class families and working families in Illinois, that's the way to go. And he says he's been a longtime supporter of a millionaire's tax. But, you know, it's the deadline to basically get this pass out of Springfield is May 3rd. And that means, you know, lawmakers have like just a few weeks now to get not only just like a majority, but a supermajority in both chambers, right? So typically bills will need just like a simple majority to pass out of the House and the Senate. But with a constitutional amendment like this, you would need a supermajority. You know, I did ask him, I was like, you know, are you like worried that they won't be able to accomplish this in time? And he was like, you know, things can happen in Springfield at the drop of a hat, right?
Of course.
He says, like, you know, like, even though we have, what, like a few weeks, 3 weeks left, like, things can change in a matter of days. So just stay tuned. And I was like, okay, yeah, sure.
We're going to check back in on the Springfield agenda in just a minute. But I do want to pivot to the agenda in Chicago's city council today. Claire, packed agenda, including this vote to see if the council can override the mayor's veto trying to protect a tipped minimum wage hike. What else is going on?
Well, we should just note with that vote you're talking about, Alderman set to vote on that halting of the tipped worker wage bump, set to eliminate the sub-minimum wage in Chicago in 2028. But we remember Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson voted the city council's initial 30-18 vote last month. That was vetoed. And right now they need a supermajority, which Mawa just so eloquently explained what that is.
And they're
signaling this morning that they just do not have the votes. They know they're not going to get the votes, but they're still going to vote anyway. Mm-hmm. So the other kind of big ticket item we're watching is a measure to increase taxi rates as sort of a lifeline to this industry that we know has been really, you know, hit hard by Lyft and Uber. So this would be a 20% fare hike, would be the first in a decade in the city.
Ooh.
So we'll see where the council lands on that. And then we talked about this a little bit yesterday on your show, Sasha, but the council also taking up a ban on Chicago police officers joining, supporting, or fundraising for extremist groups like the far-right Proud Boys. So we'll see what happens with that as well.
Yeah. Interesting. What other stories are you following, aside from what's on the council agenda?
Well, we discussed this, and Ambar might remember this, that delivery robot that crashed into the bus shelter in Westtown last month. And then a couple of videos went viral.
Has he been charged?
He's apologizing.
Ooh.
They are apologizing, we should say, for driving through the glass wall of that Grand Avenue shelter center Sun Times reporting this morning that Serve Robotics has placed an ad at that shelter stating that the robot was very sorry for the damage. The shelter was fixed just a couple of days later, but in a statement, Serve is saying that they own the mistake of their bot and they are committed to improving the technology. So kind of a fun little bookend to that story for now. He might end up back there and we'll see.
But this covers him. We'll be nicer this time. We'll be more understanding.
He's keeping it civilized.
Have you run into these robots, Umbar?
I haven't run into them, but I've seen them.
Yeah, I've seen them while I'm driving. I've seen them like from a distance.
Yeah.
But they haven't been, you know, sort of in my way just yet.
But I think this is an attempt with the marketing to give them more kind of a face and an identity now that we know that they can apologize for being bad robots.
And the fact that we're talking about them like humans is kind of hilarious.
Right. I don't know if I like that.
Yeah.
They're coming.
Oh, boy. Mawa, let's check back in on Springfield. Hundreds of people rallied yesterday in the Capitol. This was in an effort to save SNAP benefits. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so with the HR1 federal law that was passed and pushed by President Donald Trump, you know, the new work requirements going into effect means that a lot of people could lose their SNAP eligibility. And so advocacy groups are estimating that by May 1st, which is also, you know, less than a month away, people, there would be, the original estimates were 200,000, but now, thankfully, advocacy groups are saying that since more people are aware of the new work requirements and are applying for eligibility, that number has actually dropped, or the projected number has actually dropped to 165,000. Still a lot, right? But basically, you know, a lot of these families and advocacy groups did come down to Springfield yesterday to push for these two bills. And one bill would basically create an emergency fund for people who have lost SNAP benefits. It's kind of like a temporary emergency fund through the state.
Right.
Just so they could, you know, like pay for their meals for the time being.
Right.
Right? And the second bill would expand this program that's already being run in the state of Illinois. It basically is like a food assistance program to those who are applying to seek, or those who are applying for asylee and refugee status. This bill would basically expand it to include people who are like asylee seekers and have been granted the status. So unfortunately, the two bills haven't really been called up for committee votes or on the floor, but like we were talking about earlier, you know, that things can really change. And if there's a big enough groundswell movement, which it certainly there, we saw that yesterday with all these people who came for the rally, I think, you know, that they have a pretty decent chance of maybe getting the bill heard on the floor, at least.
Mm-hmm. Let's look ahead to some summer fun, Umbar. We got the Summer Smash coming in June. Lala, of course, all of the big concerts and festivals coming, but the lineup's just been announced for Summer Smash. So what should we know? Who's going to hit the stage?
Yeah. So as you said, festival season is right around the corner.
It is basically here.
Last week.
Outfits are being planned right
yes,
now.
Yes, they are. They are actually. Last week, Michelada Fest dropped their lineup as well, which is great. They're
excellent.
Back after canceling last year. But speaking of Summer Smash, there's a lot of local talent taking the stage, from G Herbo to Chief Keef, who just dropped an album.
Really?
Which I'm very excited about. So he'll be there, Waka Flocka. Northwest, Kanye's 12-year-old
daughter
will be
performing
on stage.
Okay.
So yeah, there's a lot of really interesting artists coming through. So we'll see how it unfolds this year.
Very interesting about Northwest. I mean, I know that she's been dabbling a lot, you know, sort of like her dad, in producing and making beats and things like that and posting on social media. But to see her take the stage, that'd be kind of cool. She's so young.
Yeah, she's definitely seems to be following her dad's footsteps.
But that's the crowd for her, right? Summer Smash.
Yeah.
What other stories are you following before I let you go? I want to hear from you and Mawa.
Yeah. Well, again, the film festival is kicking off tomorrow. So I talked to all four directors, the cast and crew of the four short films that were locally made here.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And you've got that piece coming out?
Yeah, so that'll be coming out later this week.
Yay!
I've also been following the closure of, or not the closure of, but it's a venue in Berwyn called the Berwyn Eagles Club.
Okay.
So they are an iconic wrestling venue for over 20 years, have produced really some of like the greatest wrestlers of our time.
Wow.
And so they've gotten their permits pulled, so there will be no more wrestling shows. So there's a lot of questions about like where will be the new home for Chicago wrestling, especially the really hardcore stuff.
Interesting.
So, More from me soon.
Yes. And Mawa, what's on your radar?
The Bears bill, of course. Yes. I'm starting to think that that will probably come down on like May 31st, you know, the last day of session at like 2 a.m. They're going to drop that bill.
Of course.
Of course, right?
Where will our Bears play?
Who knows? Will they be the Gary Berries or will they remain the Chicago Bears? Stay tuned.
Mawa will let us know. That's WBEZ's Claire Lane and Mawa Iqbal and Ambar Colon with the Sun-Times.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Sienna Greaves, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.